The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Well, good morning, everyone. And what I'll attempt to talk about today is the idea that Buddhist practice can be considered a practice of all-inclusive inclusion. And as a society, the issues of inclusion are very important for us. There's a lot of division in our society in all kinds of different ways. Seems like, you know, every day there's a new painful way in which people are divided among each other. But I like to think of Buddhist practice as being learning how to be inclusive in a particular way. And for Buddhists, at least, this particular way is a foundation for perhaps inclusion work of all kinds. And to introduce this idea, I'd like to say that there are sometimes considered to be two very general phases of Buddhist practice. There's an initial phase that sometimes in some Buddhist traditions called the preparatory phase. And then there's the phase where the practice actually begins. And for many of us, the preparatory phase is what people think of as Buddhist practice, and it's fine to do that. But there's a shift that happens at some point. So the preparatory phase is when people begin their practice, perhaps out of some inspiration, some trust, or some idea or feeling or logic that this practice makes a lot of sense. Or it's been told that it's a good thing to do. And so I'll try it out. I'll check it out. And so I'm going to give myself over to it and experiment and give it a benefit of the doubt. And I'll do what they say for a while. They tell me to keep coming back to my breath over and over again. Well, they've been doing this for a few millennia. So they must have good reasons for this. So I'll try it. Sit down, close my eyes, and come back to my breath over and over again. Or, you know, all the different instructions that we have and practice we do. And some people can be quite inspired by this phase, this contact with the practice. They're inspired by the teachings, what they point to, how they explain this world that we're in, how they explain ourselves, our suffering. And also it makes a lot of sense for some people. And people when they first sit down, a few people when they first sit down or as they get into it, something really resonates in some deep way. And so there's kind of this beginning phase, preparing. At some point, there's a transformation. It doesn't have to be a sudden transformation. It could be a slow one, where a person knows something about the practice, about the Dharma, about Buddhism, that's essentially or inherently personal. That there's some real experience of what happens as we practice, some experience of being different through the practice that is so clear and so obvious in a sense to oneself that it's like now a person, I know what the practice is. Now I really understand. Before I kind of was inspired, it was meaningful, I kind of thought I knew what it was. In fact, I told all my friends and relatives, this is what it is. but it was, you know, really kind of maybe intellectual, it was book learned, it was logically put together. But wow, now I know. It would be someone like who read books on swimming and didn't know how to swim. And the books are really well written, it's convincing, it's logical, it's possible to swim, I'm inspired it's possible to swim, I'll read another book about swimming. And wow, yes, this is fantastic. And they'll tell all their friends, you know, you can learn to swim, it's a great swim. And then at some point they decide to try to swim. And at some point they've learned to swim. Now I know. Now I really know what those books are about because I can swim. And it's a whole different experience about it. Okay, now I can really try to develop my swimming and whatever I do. So it's a little bit like that, these two phases. And when this kind of language is used for Buddhism, Buddhist practice, it's sometimes said, maybe it's provocative, or maybe it's meant to be inspiring and not discouraging. They say that Buddhist practice begins in that second phase. Everything before is just preparatory to get to there. And it begins because now there's a personal reference point for it. Personal, oh, that's what I'm trying to do. That's the home for it. That's the connection. That's what can happen with inside of me. And so at that point, for some people at least, becomes inherently or innately practical. It doesn't become some abstract ideas, some generalizations, some ideas about some ultimate goal, which is abstract, or you know, enlightenment is can be all kinds of lofty ideas about what enlightenment is, and that can be inspiring or daunting to people, depending. But now there's something that's, you know, the people might say, well, that enlightenment is good, maybe, but I know something now. This is what I think the path is. Now I know what this practice is all about. So one of those things, about one of the ways to talk about experiencing it for oneself and knowing something, is one knows that clinging, grasping, craving, being really attached and holding tight to things is overrated. In fact, it's not really worth its promise. Whatever the advertisement is, whatever the public relations message is about the value of clinging or craving or holding on tight, being attached, it's not really true. It's fake news. And one knows this because one has been to the other side of clinging, of craving. One has in some very clear, obvious way experienced what it's like to be breathing, what it's like to be aware, what it's like to be relaxed in this body, what it's like to have a heart that feels open and uncontracted and undefended. Clearly enough that one has experience of this is a state where there's no clinging. Or the clinging the way I usually experience it is really absent here. And my usual way of clinging, it's not really something I want to live with anymore. It has no value. It has no purpose. In fact, it undermines me. It gets in the way of me. And so for some people at this phase, this beginning phase, is now that practice really becomes more to the point, I understand that when I cling, that's where the practice is. That's what I'm trying to work with and not cling. And it can be, a challenging times. It's not easy once one knows this. But one is at least has some confidence, some personal experience, oh, this is what it's about. And one doesn't have to go into all the books and try to understand the complicated, philosophical teachings of Buddhism, because it's not any more complicated than having spent a lifetime with your hand in a fist and finally understanding you don't have to keep it in a fist all the time. It's okay to have the hand open. And it feels so good to have it open. And when the tendency to make a fist happens, wait a minute. I think I've done enough of that. This doesn't really feel good. Let me keep opening it. Let me keep opening it. And in that struggle or that practice of keeping it open, there is maybe a lot of debates that goes on. Some of those lawyers of the mind will come along and try to convince you that, but this in this circumstance, it's good to cling. This is a time, this Buddhist stuff, I don't have time for that right now. I just got to get through this and cling my way through, be attached right through it or something, because this is so important, And so then if there's an honest debate going on or really looking at it, deeply questioning it, not just accepting, yes, that's the case, But really questioning that and looking at that and practicing with that and going to the other side of that and seeing, well, you know, maybe it's overrated. There is another way. And then as we do this and learning how not to cling, not to grasp, not to be attached, then to discover it's not just a matter of being non-attached, but in that non-attached state, there is energy, there is movement, there is power even, there's action that can arise out of it. Kind of like from the inside out. It's not a passive state. Or say something a little differently, maybe non-clinging has a certain passivity to it. So it's maybe appropriate to be a little bit questioning, you know, is that being too passive? But it's the passivity of a door that's been opened. You know, a door that's open is passive. You know, the space that's been created in the open door is completely passive. It doesn't just there, it's just there. It doesn't, not doing anything. It's just not troubling anyone, the space. And but now we can go through. Something can happen in that space. And so the same thing here within ourselves. Non-clinging creates the door, and it's remarkable what can arise, what can flow, what can emerge out of that. So at some point, Buddhist practice is to understand that the practice is metaphorically to keep the hand open. And not just to keep a hand open, but to allow, to hold whatever happens in our life in that open hand. And if you, many of you maybe can't see this, but maybe after the talk, if you'd like to go up here and look, in this statue of the Buddha that we have here, his left hand is laying on his lap in a very calm and peaceful way, just resting there. And in the resting there in its hands, his palm is open to the sky. And I like to think that almost everything, all the different postures and things about a Buddha statue are highly symbolic. And this is symbolic of how we can be inclusive of all things. We want to hold everything in the field of our awareness without clinging, grasping, being greedy, being hateful, being spiteful, being resentful, or being deluded. So if we take the hand as a metaphor for our heart or our awareness, then greed would be the hand that would be reaching all the time and grabbing and holding on. The aversive tendency maybe would be pushing away or closing down or hitting or blaming or attacking or doing something. And the deluded is just the hand just kind of spinning around, kind of like, you know, not knowing what to do and what happens, just anxious and confused. But to have confidence and trust that it's okay to have the metaphorical hand open all the time to experience what is here, no matter what it is, prior to reacting. Almost like prior to acting and doing. And because if we don't have the hand open, if we don't have the heart open and the mind in this kind of open, receptive way without clinging, then chances are that we're going to be acting, reacting, disconnected from ourselves. We're going to be acting from ideas. We're going to be acting from the emotional impacts we have. And in that reaction from the emotional impact of being uncomfortable or having some kind of desire pop up, we're more like acting on the surface of our being. We're acting through the filter of ideas and thoughts and relationships that are kind of abstract or kind of distant, as opposed to really being grounded in that deep kind of intimacy or connectivity to what's happening. And so that our response can well up from within, below the surface of our conditioning, below the surface of our bias, and below the surface of our ordinary desires and attachments and ideas of things, what should and shouldn't happen. there's a time for some deeper response to happen. And then in that deeper response, then maybe we welcome in some of our thoughts and ideas and memories and concepts and conventions that we have. It isn't in the way we don't have them, but they are supports for this open hand to know how to respond. They aren't the closed hand or the reactive hand that has the precedence. So this second phase of Buddhist practice is a time when we really trust it's okay to have this tender, sensitive, open hand present in order to include and feel everything that goes on. There was we had here at IMC on Friday a wonderful Buddhist teacher, an African-American Buddhist teacher named Zenju Earthlin Manuel. And she wrote a beautiful book called The Way of Tenderness, where she talks about a lot about her own Buddhist practice and her struggles to overcome or work through or come to the other side of her own deep struggle with being, in this country, African-American, being a woman, and being a lesbian. And the book's called The Way of Tenderness. You know, as you know, that the path of tenderness through these tremendous sufferings, challenges, and divisions that our society has seen. And in that book, she has this wonderful sentence. She has a lot of wonderful sentences, but what struck my mind this week was, she says, the particular suffering of any one individual is the general suffering for the rest of us. And I love this sentence. I didn't quite have it exactly, you know, paraphrasing a little bit. But I love the sentence. We're not separated from other people. What the suffering of other people, in some ways, is our own as well. And to treat people's suffering as out there, and not taking the time to feel it in the tenderness of our hearts or this open hand, to experience it, feel it in our body, feel it in our heart, feel it in our mind in some deep way, to really kind of let it kind of register someone else's suffering or our suffering in relationship to them. Not because of them, but, you know, our discomfort, you know. I saw, I was here a couple of years ago, I was right here a block away in Redwood City, and I sometimes walk around there's a high school there, and I walked around the school property, and there's a kind of a park-like setting in the front of the school. But there's this a big fence around it. So, you know, you can walk in, you know, sidewalk in the city sidewalk in front, or you can walk in the park-like setting, but you have to kind of go a long way around to get to the sidewalk. And there were some people, two or three people, walking down the sidewalk. I hardly noticed them. I was maybe talking to someone on my walk. And a pickup truck drove by, and someone yelled a derogatory, one of these very terrible derogatory terms we have in English for other people of a certain type, the race. And then it followed that by saying, go back to where you came from. So here, right here in Redwood City. And if I had been on the sidewalk, I would have somehow gone and accompanied or showed the person that they weren't alone, who that was said to. But I was kind of, you know, it was a big fence, it was far away, and it happened very quickly. So, you know, I didn't really do anything. But it was painful to experience that, to see that happen, and to know that this is part of our society, this kind of thing is way too often. But to hold that in the open hand, to be able to take time and to experience that and be with that, and to hold that. If my friend Zenju, this teacher, had been the one on the sidewalk and that was told to her, what I know about her, she would have done that. She really knows what the Buddhist practice is. And she would have held it in an open hand. Her own suffering, the suffering of the other people. She knows how to come back and rest in her tenderness, in the softness, in the presence. She might have then done something. I don't know what she would have done. I don't know what I would have done if I was on the sidewalk rather than behind this fence. But to hold our suffering, our personal suffering, the particular suffering to ourselves, and learn how to hold it in an open hand, or the equivalent inside, rather than learning how to fix it, rather than learning how to get rid of it, how to solve it, how to free ourselves from it, first and foremost. I think at the heart of what Buddhist practice, when it really is Buddhist practice, it's not really about getting rid of our suffering, first and foremost, but it's rather holding it in our hands. This too I have to hold in my open hands. My fear that I have, the anxiety I have, I know that I know what has to be done. Just hold it, as if awareness is two cupped hands that comes up underneath my fear, anxiety, and just holds it, and is willing and confident that just tenderly or carefully or openly feel it and sense it. Because we've learned that if we do that, all kinds of things begin to shift and change. Things begin to open, they begin to unravel, they begin to solve, they begin to clarify, and they allow us a chance or something deeper to arise within us that can meet that, and wisdom can understand it, deeper response, deeper compassion, care, something can happen. That can't happen when we feel our suffering, our personal suffering, or any suffering, and an automatic pilot, oh, something's got to happen, I have to fix this. Something, you know, I better get out those books and, you know, study, and learn, or I better analyze, or I better, you know, maybe if I just get more concentrated in meditation, then I just blow it out of existence. You know, or I just need to, you know, get away from it at all costs. When Buddhist, so that might be useful to kind of find relief, to find some space where, time and place where we're not suffering, in order to really be able to get deeper and deeper into practice. But in this way I was talking about today, when Buddhist practice really begins, when really starts it, one is no longer trying to get away from suffering. One is trying to not meet suffering with any clinging, with any resistance, with any attachments, without any aversions. And one knows the nature of a confused mind, where we get all confused and caught up in it, to know that even being confused about it is not where the path is found. And the path is found in something amazingly simple. And that is to hold it in the tenderness, hold it in the softness of an open hand, or two hands cupped underneath it. Just this. Really be there, feel it. And for many of us, but not everyone, for many of us, I think the place to learn this is our own personal suffering. That's maybe what comes first. But then as we learn it, it's also the suffering of the world around us that we hold the same way. We're not supposed to do Buddhist practice so that we're free of our own suffering, and then we can just kind of, you know, go forget everybody else and just go play. Because I think when the heart is open, when the hand is open, it's available to all the winds, whatever way the wind blows, wherever direction the wind comes from, it blows across the soft hand. So if we know something about the open, soft presence to this world, the winds of our own suffering blow across that open, we hold it, and the winds of the world blow across it. And we've learned just to be with this. And this is one of the great gifts that we can give to our friends, our family, our society, people we meet, is our ability to be with them without reacting to what's happening, without needing to fix or get away from, but just kind of be there with it. Sometimes people will think we're being too passive because we're not worried enough, you know, anxious enough with them or something. And sometimes people will feel that maybe it's uncomfortable because they're just, because we're somehow making space for the difficulty of the situation, whereas most people cover it over with fast talk or doing something. But to make space for it and just hold it and be with it. And one of the things that, one of the ways I see this kind of the open hand, you know, it's really some deep inner sensitivity that we're capable of, sensitivity that is born and lives through the body. So a lot of it is embodied presence. The whole body is like an open hand, becomes like an open hand. The whole body is allowed to feel and sense what's happening with ourselves inwardly and outwardly. But it's almost like now if you allow me, I'll change the metaphor. It's almost like we have deep inside of us, maybe at the core or something, we have a light bulb that's always been on, but mostly it's been covered over by lots and lots of grime, lots of dust. And as we do the practice, we're slowly kind of cleaning that grime, the dust off it, so that the light can finally begin to shine through. And as it shines through, and finally, eventually, the whole bulb is, you know, been cleaned, and so it radiates in all directions, the light. And so whatever that light shines on is what we've learned to hold tenderly, to hold the present for. But because a light starts in the center of who we are, inside of us, that light first goes through us. It just happens to be a person that's there. Kind of a coincidence. Okay, this is the person, this here. And so you'll see, you know, one of the first places you'll see in that light, if you're really present, is what's happening to you. The impact the world, the impact you have on yourself, the world has on you. You'll experience your own suffering and your own joys, your own capacity for compassion and wisdom and the opposite. And then as if the light is allowed to travel further, then it encounters what's going on around you, the people around you. But if the light skips over you and goes directly to the world around you, which it does for many people, because they don't know how to be present for themselves, then all this unconscious, subconscious reactivity, bias, thoughts, beliefs will often come along and influence how we speak and what we say and what we do. But if really the light goes up through us first, then there's a much better chance that we'll respond and be with the world with much more wisdom and care and compassion and what's appropriate. And so there is a kind of priority that Buddhist practice gives to your personal experience. But not because it's selfish or self-preoccupying. It's just in a certain kind of way, because of where your light begins, your awareness begins, in a certain powerful way, you can say, for you, the world begins in you. And if you want to care for the world, you really have to care for yourself, because the whole world begins in you. When you wake up in the morning, you just woke up the world. You gave birth to the world. So to really be careful with what's here, and the Buddhist practice, if you do it regularly, it becomes second nature to do that. Just like if you know, if it was a habit was to hold your hand clenched in a fist, that's second nature. That's what's kind of automatic. But if you keep practicing keeping your hand open, eventually it's second nature to keep it open. And then you walk through the world with it open. You don't think about it too much. This is what you do. So if Buddhist practice is done regularly enough, this keep coming back, being present, opening up the light, holding whatever's here with cupped hands, just being with it. Not trying to always focus on fixing suffering, but rather being with it. That at some point that becomes second nature. And so when you go through the world, you don't have to do so much work to pay attention, to have your light kind of, you know, stop, to really spend a lot of time with what's here with you. That's kind of obvious. And so there's much more space for your light to flow out more widely and take into account with the world around you, and maybe not see it inner and outer being so separate. It's just whatever is here. So you might try it. And so what I'm saying is that there's two phases of Buddhist practice. The second phase, a person really knows what Buddhist practice is about. And it's a phase where we really know what it's about is not clinging, not being caught in greed or hatred or delusion. And to not do that is to also, same time, kind of the other side of that, is to have confidence in the open hand. To know that's the way to be. Because to be greedy or hateful or deluded or confused is, we're kind of doing the equivalent of closing up or losing the open hand. So to know that I don't want to live with greed, hate, and delusion anymore. I don't want to be attached. I want to have that open hand. And to have confidence in that. That's what happens when Buddhist practice, when a person really begins Buddhist practice, the second phase. So some of you have already started Buddhist practice in the second phase this way, and some of you haven't. For those of you who haven't, do it anyway. You don't have the proof that it works yet, or that this is what it's about. But try doing it as if you've already, you know, as if you really can do it. Try just having the soft palms of your hands that live in your heart or in your mind or in your awareness. Just try holding it open. And then whatever occurs, whatever is happening, imagine that it's just, you allow it to just rest in your hands. That doesn't mean that you have to be for it. Doesn't mean you're against it. It's not about being for or against anything. It's just holding it and seeing what happens, feeling and sensing, and not giving in to greed, hatred, and delusion, not giving in to clinging or hatred. Just hold it. And if that's not enough, that the fact that the Buddha sits here all the time, you know, he's been up there on our altar for very, you know, well, he's been here at IMC for a very long time. I've never seen him tighten up that left hand. It just always seems to stay open. But having, you know, the idea that your hand is the Buddha's hand, that your awareness can be like the Buddha's awareness, just holding things there. If that image is not strong enough, then you can notice that what's also there, or if you need stronger medicine, his hand is resting in his lap. So if you can't hold everything in your Buddha hand, maybe then put everything in your Buddha lap. Maybe you need more space for it. And see what happens. See what that's like. Not to fix, get rid of, but just really offer that presence to your experience. And in doing that, if you're in that first phase of practice, if you keep doing that, I'm pretty confident that you'll learn soon enough for yourself that greed, hate, and delusion, clinging and attachment is not really worthwhile. It's not really in your best interest. It's not really a healthy thing to do. And then you'll start Buddhist practice again. and again, and again. So may we all begin, may we all be beginners over and over again. So thank you very much.